Hey, welcome to episode 39 of Dome Theory Sports and Culture. I'm Bobby Manning, and we just finished watching Game 5 of the NBA Finals, and wow, this affirmed my take, my feeling that this was a series, an interesting one, a compelling one, one that's worth watching. The Heat come out and beat the Lakers in an elimination game. Jimmy Butler, who already had a 40-point triple-double in this series, one of, I believe it was 10 or 11 30-point triple-doubles in finals history. We'll add him to the times two on that list. I believe only LeBron James had multiple 30-point triple-doubles. Well, now it's Jimmy Butler serving up a 35, 12, and 11 game with five steals in a do-or-die game for the Heat. Not only that, he plays 47 minutes. I'm running out of stuff to say about this guy. The notion that with Chicago, with Minnesota, with Philadelphia, three teams in middling positions that could have built up around him or torn down by getting rid of him, all became worse by relinquishing him because of his intensity, because of his difficulty to deal with when it came to teammates. Well, now we know if you surround him with a group who wants to fight, work through his intensity, improve off the expectations that he has, this guy is not only top 15 player, he's a player that you could conceivably win a championship around. They're within two. Now, I'm not going to pick the Heat to win this series or anything. It's still LeBron James and still Anthony Davis on the other side. 40 points for LeBron in this one, 28 for Anthony Davis, who came up hobbled in that third quarter, middle point around that game, second or third quarter. He didn't look great in the fourth. Still played 42 minutes, 28-12. He'll be fine going forward. The question is, will Miami get another 30-point triple from Butler? Because it feels like that's what they need at this point with Goran Dragic out. I don't know if Goran Dragic's going to play. Seems like he's in play to get back into the series. He's tried each of the last two games to step in with that torn plantar fascia. That injury, though, and I'm not even thinking about free agency. That's the first concern people would bring up. There's a pain tolerance. There's a riskiness to his career as a whole in going through that injury. So they could certainly use him. But so far, Butler's creation, which is what gets me most about him, those 11 assists, the passes he strings in the pick and roll, and the putback he had in that third quarter, going up like a center above the rim to put that back through an and one. This game from him was iconic, and I've already said this about his game three. Jimmy Butler, and not only the performances on the court, his demeanor off the court, this praise that he brings for his teammates, so much the star on the team carries that I attitude, and he continues against all perceptions that he should be taking over this team to say Tyler Hero should be doing it. Duncan Robinson on a night like tonight, 26 points, 7 of 13. First thing he brings up after the game is a performance like that from one of his teammates. When you look up and down the Heat tonight, it was nice to see Kendrick Nunn do something for them. Bam Adebayo has fought through some enormous pain to play in these last two games and has given them an admirable performance at center, where they would have been playing Kelly Olynyk. Kelly Olynyk plays zero in this game. Big difference so far in this one. So there's the Heat. I love this team. They beat the Celtics. Would I love to see the Celtics in this spot? Certainly. It'd be interesting. It'd be compelling. They'd find a way to compete in this, just like Miami would, in my mind. But Miami has a special level of toughness, grit, and sturdiness at the top in their number one that Boston didn't. Boston, it was always like, who's going to be the number one? It'd be Jason Tatum many nights, but he'd have lapses that you don't see from Jimmy Butler. Butler's two-way prowess, his ability to defend LeBron, play the entire game, and give everything you need offensively. This was a perfect game tonight. 35 points, 12 of 12 at the free throw line, 11 of 19 from the field. Banks in a three tonight, which he didn't have in that 40-point game, which was even more impressive from a scoring standpoint. But tonight, 12 rebounds, 11 assists, and those five steals, forcing turnovers again on the Heat. Four from LeBron, 15 overall as a team. And you look at LA's scoring chart, 68 of 108 come from the top two. Dwight starts in this game, still looks like a mess. He's trying to post up all game long. I've always had questions about this team's second unit, and they're right there at the end of this game. Another 1-7 from Rondo. Caruso's Caruso. KCP has been giving them performance in this one. Contributions, cutting layups, threes. So he's been there, but where's their fourth option? Danny Green, as they're triple, quadruple teaming LeBron on the final possession of the game, gets the kick out above the break, three, wide open, and front rims it, goes to Markieff Morris. Markieff's been great for LA throughout much of this playoff run, but decides with the shot clock running down to force a pass that looked like a half shot, half pass, over his head and out of bounds. And all of a sudden you saw LeBron doing the JR 2018 again. Lakers fans are scared now. I saw it online. They see Scott Foster on game six. They see the way Jimmy Butler's playing. And they see the contributing cast of this LA team play the way they did tonight. Let me do some quick math in my head. 12 of 25, 33, 14 of 40, 42. 14 of 42 was a contributing cast of LA in this one. This is the downfall of this team. They bank so much in two players. All of a sudden, one comes up a little hobbled. Another gets triple teamed in crunch time, and you end up with a result like that. Unfortunately, LeBron got that pep talk from Rajon Rondo about the body language, so you didn't see the JR stance at the end of this one. And it wasn't as egregious as JR's motion. What could he have done with 5 seconds left? I don't know. Anything other than that, I'd assume. So there's some quick final thoughts. I could see this one going seven. When it comes down to seven, though, that talent's going to win. This one's going to hinge on Davis's health, because if he's hobbled the rest of the way, hesitant, limited like he was in the fourth quarter of this one, I certainly give the Heat a chance to win this one. And I gave them a chance to win this series from the start. You can listen to last episode with Justin Poole, and he called this one a sweep. All of a sudden, we're going six games. That Miami team is the balls. I have no other way to say it, and I'm not a big balls talker, but balls is the only way you can describe that team. Two guests today, unexpected finals. That's my theme today. This was the great finals that was unexpected. Ratings down, screw it. We're going to have this conversation. Let me chalk this one up in 30 seconds to the ratings. People's lives are in upheaval. We have 7% unemployment in this country. People are searching for jobs. People are searching for stability in their households. And we look at the bottom 60% of this economy. They're rushing to get it right now. So they're not watching the finals. They're not sitting back and relaxing after a long day. Now, fortunately, I and others have had the ability to do that. That's certainly my job, to some degree, is to watch these games. But if you're grinding, if you're out there in that real world right now, I don't think LeBron and Jimmy Butler are your priority. We also have other mitigating factors, but since the baseball, football, hockey, and basketball ratings are down, that's number one. Number two, basketball in particular, you got those Reddit streams. People can talk about normal stream all you want, but people are still watching those Reddit streams. Not me. I watch ABC at this point. Others, though, those Reddit streams, if you don't want to pay for anything, If all you got is your computer, your tablet, that's what you're running on, those Reddit streams are still getting people by. People, when they saw Miami going to the series, a little less star power than a Boston. I feel like Boston would have been a tick above. But when people saw Miami, especially if there's injuries after game one, there was that sense, that overwhelming sentiment that this was going to be a sweep, that this was going to be a breeze. It's still LeBron, it's still the Lakers, it's still Davis. The star power they needed in the series is there. So that brings me back to number one. When you see those compounding factors all along each other. Now, the argument of the racial politics factor, it exists. I'm sure there's a racist out there that got turned off by the kneeling. But what do we say in statistics? If it's close enough to zero, it is zero. And the big numbers are constant around sports. This human rights, it's part of sports as a whole. Unless these other sports are going to turn back on it. But how would that look now? Especially for the NFL. To commit to social justice for a year, turn right back. For a league that's responded to a COVID outbreak with fines, as Roger Goodell has, I guess it wouldn't be all that stunning. So, unexpected NBA Finals. Let me get into the origin of Jimmy Butler with Jeff Goodman today, who covered him in college, of course. A two-star recruit out of junior college into Marquette. This guy got to be one of the more improbable NBA Finals superstars, maybe the most since, I don't know, Dennis Rodman. So we'll get into a little bit of Butler's backstory in our short segment here with Jeff Goodman. Later, Mel Smith and I talk about the Rolling Stones, and you want to talk about improbable. That list was phenomenal. How often do we go crazy and parse over lists? Lists are like the ultimate get people mad move, but Rolling Stone come out with a top 500 albums ever list that appeased the masses. I don't know how you feel about it. If you got any thoughts on it, hit me up, bmann260@gmail.com or at realbobmanning. But I'm going to get into that list after Goodman with Mel Smith. Music Monday special edition over the weekend here as we talk about the finals, Jimmy Butler, and 500 greatest albums ever with Mel Smith here on Dome Theory. The 98th Bobcast ever. We're pushing toward 100, so help us out as we bring you something great for episode 100. Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, we're on all those spots, realbobmanning.com. Can also get our segments over on the Dome Theory stream playlist on YouTube at CLNS Media. I'm Bobby Manning, and here is Jeff Goodman. You've seen a lot of finals. Where's that one rank for an individual performance?
I mean, again, when you're taking out two of the best players on their team, two and three, really, if you look at it, Bam Adebayo's been terrific. His versatility, Dragic has been tremendous, you know, kind of finding the fountain of youth a little bit. Butler, what he did, I never thought Jimmy Butler could be the number one guy on a team contending for the NBA Finals. But obviously, he proved me wrong. He's a guy that doesn't necessarily rely on the three-point shot. And in this day and age, that's so rare. Everybody else, as we've seen with the Boston Celtics, everybody from Jaylen Brown to Daniel Tice jacks up threes. And Jimmy Butler is still an old-school player and also has an old-school mentality. And we saw that. I mean, he's a guy that's just an absolute killer. He's always been that way. And that's really disrupted locker rooms in the past where he's been, whether it's been Chicago, Minnesota, even Philly a little bit, but it's the perfect fit with him in Miami. And, you know, we'll see if this is really a series going forward or if it was just one blip, one game. I think it probably was, but it was one hell of a game for Jimmy Butler.
Well, I love how that's what the Heat embrace. They talk about it all the time. They're like, we accept this guy. We embrace this guy. We love his personality. In fact, I saw someone say that last night was what everyone wanted to see in that Minnesota blow up at practice where he first the first teamers with the third team and just completely whipped them off the court. And you said it yourself, no 3-point attempts in that game. That was the first time since Shaquille O'Neal that someone put up 40 points in the finals without a 3-point attempt, which is just unbelievable. I love his game. It's beautiful. He can pull up from anywhere in that mid-range area, get to the rim. Free throw machine, probably the best guy at getting to the line in the league. And then I hear after the game, they're talking about Marquette, and I'm like, Marquette, because, you know, Dwayne Wade, Marquette, Jimmy Butler, Marquette. And I don't even remember this guy in college. He wasn't very heralded coming out of high school. He comes out of junior college, as you said. Like, you know, what was this guy in high school compared or in college compared to where he is now?
Yeah, I mean, the crazy thing, a JUCO kid, Buzz Williams brought him in. And I remember the funny part is he and Jay Crowder were on the same team.
Yeah.
And Marquette was absolutely loaded. Crowder was the Big East player of the year, I think, his senior year. And then Jimmy, I think, was the Big East player of the year the next season. And those guys really kind of brought the mentality to that Marquette program that Buzz Williams wanted, right? The lunch pail, under-recruited, nobody wanted us. And Jimmy's had that mentality throughout college, throughout his NBA career. And really hasn't gotten away from that. And again, I think that's the key here in Miami is Pat Riley and Spoelstra have put the right group around him to let him lead, to let him be him. And Dragic has been kind of and Bam have been the perfect guys to kind of co-lead this team, if you will, with Jimmy Butler, because they are tough, hard-nosed, lunch pail type guys that just want to win. And you see that with Jimmy that – again, it hasn't always worked out in the past, but in Miami, it's the perfect fit.
They're not going to go all the way. I think we can agree with that. They just don't have the bodies. Bam might come back. Dragic probably not. And then you got Davis and LeBron on the other side. But I remember, you know, probably first, second round, I was ranking NBA players. I probably put him around, you know, 15 in that Paul George, Jason Tatum area. I know you have Tatum top 10. But, you know, this run – blowing through Indiana, blowing through the Bucks, beating the Celtics pretty handily. And now, you know, even taking a game from the Lakers with what they have, you know, what does this do for this guy standing in the NBA?
Yeah, I think you got to put him in the top 10 now. I do. I mean, listen, he's always guarded and he's always been good in the offensive end. But what he's shown is the ability to facilitate and make guys around him better, which was never really Jimmy Butler's forte. He was more of a kind of Swiss Army knife guy. Great two-way player, but people almost put him as like a poor man's Paul George. I think now you take Jimmy Butler 100 days out of 100 over Paul George today, yeah, because you know Jimmy Butler is going to show up every single night. With Paul George, you have no idea which Paul George is going to show up.
He can clearly lead a team. That's Jeff Goodman on Jimmy Butler. We'll talk some more finals later on. For now, thanks, Jeff.
You got it, Bobby.
Been 2 weeks since Rolling Stone released their third version, fourth version. They've done a couple of these top 500 lists of all time. I'm Bobby Manning, Mel Smith, in for the second half of Dome Theory. Nice to see you, Mel. It's been a while.
I know. It's good to be sane, but yeah, I'm glad to be back.
This has been a great year for music, and I think quite a few releases this year are going to end up on this 500 list one day. But I'll break down the gist for people because this was so interesting. I think the provoking of this list in some way is this Black Lives Matter movement we've seen this year.
Yes.
What you see out of this list is an influx of Black representation. I mean, you see these big four Black genres represented heavily in here, whether it be hip-hop, R&B, soul, or funk, heavily. Like, they're up and down this list. I think the top 100 got great hip-hop representation. And that's what I love about this list. Things shook up in a big way, in a way that they needed to, because this list specifically was long criticized of being white, rock and roll oriented, Beatles up and down, and all that stuff's still in there. I mean, those were classic works, a lot of legendary pieces, but it's been mixed up. I think I saw 186 new additions to this list, and 86 coming from 2000 on.
Yeah, that's actually a note that I had about the list, that it did include more work from Black and brown artists, even, you know, speaking to the Latina or the Latinx community. I thought that was really interesting. Well, like you said, it was all kind of sort of onset by this Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, this talk of diversity and inclusion. And I think the list does what it needs to do in that it reflects the time that we're in. So I believe the last one was in 2012. And I think the one before that was 2003, if I read that correctly. So it makes sense now that, you know, the additions are leaning more towards Black and Brown artists, but I'm definitely here for it. I was really surprised to, you know, see the number one spot.
Want to start, you know, there?
Yeah, we can. Speaking to your point of the Rolling Stones, not the Rolling Stones, but the Beatles, them losing their number one spot to What's Going On, which, I mean, in the grand scheme of it, is not a big deal for me personally, because What's Going On has always been heralded as one of the greatest albums of all time. But to see that swap was really interesting to me. So I was shocked to get to the number one spot and see Marvin Gaye. But it was, of course, well-deserved in my opinion.
And it's not like the Beatles got knocked to two. They went all the way back to 27.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, what?
They got thrown back. Now, Abbey Road was still number five on here, so they did make an appearance in the top five, but they got dropped back in a big way. And this list was, like, they didn't just change a few things around about this list. They completely revamped it. And Marvin Gaye was going on. I think Marvin Gaye had three releases on this list. This one tops him, of course. What's Going On, the title track, of course. A song that during the late 60s, a couple of years after 1968, probably the only period of time as tumultuous as right now in anyone else's lifetime. Like, I know a few people were around for World War II, but I think putting that number one amongst a bunch of other either protest songs or songs that reflected the times or just songs of the moment, it was indicative of that. Now, none of the songs this year, whether it be Anderson .Paak's Lockdown or the Roddy Ricch and the Baby track, like those songs eventually might get looked back on as indicative songs of 2020. But for now, we're left with a track from 1971 that similarly represented its time. And I think that was fitting. Is this the best song ever? I don't know. That's tough to say. No. Like, it's always going to be.
I can say no.
Going to be tough. That's a hard thing to pick. Like, and you could go a million different ways with it. What's your favorite song? What is like the best musically composed song? What's the most powerful song? And what's the song that represented its era best? And they ended up choosing the fourth out of that.
Right. Exactly. I think, you know, when we like look at that criteria that you just named, especially when you look at the voters that were a part of this process, I think you do lean, or you start to lean more towards what is most apropos for this time. And this time is interesting. So I feel like the fact that they did it at this specific time, it kind of led the process to include more politically charged albums. Like, you have Black Messiah, you have Lemonade. And when we talk about politically charged, we just mean music with politics to them. Yeah. That can be sexuality. That can be, of course, racial, you know, all that type of stuff. So I think the fact that we're seeing a lot more to Pimp a Butterfly, of course that album was going to make it either way. But
it was just how high it was going to be. And frankly, I thought it was a little low. What's it come in at? 19?
Really?
19. I would have put it a little higher. Probably top 10. I mean, we're not going to argue over this one, Mel. This
one. I was like, of all time? Okay. I mean, well, yeah.
This album, fair, though. I think, and there's a broader context, there's a lot of different eras throughout hip-hop history, and I think me being stuck in this one, knowing this one most,
right,
I'm going to call it the best rap album ever. And I think it comes out on this list. Now, whether you want to call Miseducation of Lauryn Hill a strictly rap album or not, you could debate over that. But I think the quintessential rap album, greatest of all time, coming out of this list, either To Pimp a Butterfly or two spots higher than that, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy.
Exactly.
And frankly, I don't know if it's because I've gone lower on Kanye or it made me notice this more about the album.
Yeah.
And this was, you know, the infamous Fantano review there that gave it, what, a 6.5? His big thing out of that, and what I've noticed more, is that album, now it was beautiful. It was one of the most sample-driven and, you know, powerfully performed albums in hip-hop history for sure. But in terms of content, I'd say 80% was Kanye's celebrity foddings. And I agree with that. Like, those grew so much less interesting in the 10 years since, especially as we've seen him elevate his level as a celebrity status and just a political agitator. Like, at this point, no one wants to hear what he has to say. There was a time where, no matter how crazy it was, people would listen to Kanye's musings. And now it's just people want to tune him out. And I think that's going to hurt that album most in retrospect.
Absolutely. Like, it's I love talking about Kanye, not because I'm just like such a stan, but I look at his work as kind of sort of like a spoiler for him.
Yeah.
So when we look at like My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, the album is talking about fame and excess. That it's a critique on fame and excess. So there is the material that is on that album is worth listening to. I think the most interesting part and maybe disappointing part about the album is to see a figure, the same figure who made that album, kind of fall into the trappings of that album. So I think, like, when you look at his entire body of work, it tells this incredible story of him as we're seeing him now. And I think that, going back to the list, I think that the list took that into consideration, because all of his works are on the list except for this, his last three projects, I think, starting with
Yeezus Made It.
Oh yeah, Yeezus Made It, but
Pablo
didn't make it.
No,
Ye didn't make it, of course. Ye was trash, and Jesus King, of course, didn't make Jesus it King. Either. So, but I think it was really cool that, you know, all of his albums made it. But yeah, I totally agree with you on the whole To Pimp a Butterfly versus My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy conversation, because I love having that debate, and I definitely agree with you on that one.
Yeah, especially since I think the production composition of both of those albums is what defined both of them. Like, you have three of Kanye's greatest ballads ever in Power and Runaway and Monster, of course.
Right.
And then you put that against To Pimp a Butterfly, which was probably the most exploration, you know, adventurous jazz albums or jazz rap albums ever. I think To Pimp a Butterfly just ended up blowing that one away when it came to the artists that he had on there, the risks that he took, and the musicality of it. And then you can get into the performance, like the writing, the rapping, and the features on there are all better. Like, you had some good features on My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, Jay-Z, Rick Ross. There were some stand-up moments there, but it doesn't compare to Anna Wise or Thundercat or some of the features.
Yeah, George Clinton.
So that's one I had some gripes over. If I'm going to kick it back to the 500 range of this list, the one that made me so happy to see, one of my favorite artists ever, and the closest this list to comes to talking to the kids, like the people that are younger than you and I, a generation below us, I think it just misses that group and the music they're into, which makes sense because we're still living in that era and we haven't looked back on that era in retrospect yet. But the closest it comes to recognizing that era is Kid Cudi's Man on the Moon, which I think comes in at 479. It's his lone release on here. And I love the way they described it in inspiring a whole generation of sad kids, because you have so many Man on the Moon juniors, whether they took it in a more mumble rap direction or try to directly reflect him, like, you know, maybe a Chance the Rapper or a YBN Cordae, those type of guys. Like, there are so many branch offs from Kid Cudi and that album in particular, I think it would have been unfitting for it to not be on this list. And that album in particular, the flow of it, the storytelling on it, and the sadness of it. The sadness of it gets trumped by Man on the Moon 2, which I think is a better album. But when we talk about one of the five factors in putting albums on this list, I think the influence of it is a huge one. And this is an album that comes on there in an influence factor. And I love that it was on there. Like, that completed the list for me to see my favorite artist ever on there.
Yeah. That album was no surprise to me, actually. I was glad they included it, because when we think of a sound, a specific sound that is prevalent in music now, you have to go back to Kid Cudi and his work. So I thought that was really cool, definitely, to see him on there.
All right, I'll throw it back to you. Another album you want to talk about on here?
Yeah, so I guess I can go back in the, 400s. Something that was really interesting to me was seeing Juvenile's album on here, 400 Degrees. Of course, we have the legendary song, Back That Ass Up. Everybody knows that song.
I know that song. I'm not even a fan.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, it has penetrated mainstream in a way that not a lot of hip-hop, especially of that specific sound, has. So it was really incredible to see the album as a whole to, be elevated in that way.
Yeah, what do you think of that? Because I think that goes back to what's going on too, is the elevation that a single or a singularly great track off an album can boost the entire album. I think sometimes albums and singles get associated with each other, especially in the older days, where you'd go and buy an album based off the singles that were on it and kind of just see what else is in there. That's not the case as much now, where you can pick and choose any song you want off any album.
Pick and choose.
But back then, that Back That Ass Up song would drive people to go get that album, whether they like the album or not.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to reduce the influence and the impact of 400 Degrees, because especially if you're from down south in southern hip hop, especially coming out of New Orleans and the whole Louisiana, that area, the album was important. It kind of pushed forward a certain sound in hip hop, southern hip hop, that no album has. So, and also including like people like Master P and No Limit and all of that entire movement, honestly. So I don't think it was necessarily a thing of like, this album shouldn't be here. But I think, again, we have to go back to the time that we're in, also the voters that were a part of the process. I think that it had a lot to do with it, to give that album an album that many people would never consider for a list, as 500 greatest of all time, to be included. So yeah, I think that although it was a ballsy move, I respected it. I was glad to see it. So
that's an important point on this 500 list, because of some of the names they brought in to pick this. I don't know if any other names stuck out to you, but the big ones for me, Billie Eilish, The Edge, Beyonce, Her, Raekwon, and Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
All younger, well, not The Edge, but younger people who were influenced by 2000s music. So you see this massive flow of music from the 2000s, whether it be their contemporaries or their inspirations, and they forced that music not only to be on the list, but high on the list in a way that shook this up in a big way. Were there any other names on there that you think influenced this in a big way?
I don't know if it influenced it, but I was glad to see Olu from Earth Gang. I
thought really? That was cool. Did you pick some on here? Wow.
He was a voter. Organized Noise, of course. And so important to, especially when we're talking about hip hop and production and the intersection between the two. Organized Noise is Outkast. That's pretty much their whole sound. So I love seeing them a part of the process. Also, some of the writers that were a part of it, they extended the voting to journalists, and to see some of the names, like I remember that day, like some of the journalists that I follow, they were just like, I was a part of this process, and you're like, okay, cool. You check out the person, and it's like a journalist with, I don't know, like 5,000 followers. And I was like, that's really interesting. I found it to be interesting, because you would normally think that something like this would garner, people, in those high
places,
high statuses. Yeah. So
elitism. There was definitely a decentralization from this list. especially for a publication sure. that's been sure. that's been killed for being rock obsessive, inclusive, a little high minded. Yep. Like this was a full on response from them. And now, like, it's not surprising to see that from a magazine, from a publication in general today, because I think the old guard that was so entrenched, that was so powerful, that didn't need to change its ways when criticized because they had such a shoe-in. This wasn't going to happen during that time. But for ownership groups to come and go, for editorial personnel to come and go, you know, journalism's gone in a less paid, younger direction. More inclusive as well, for good reasons and bad reasons, and you end up with it with this kind of result.
Yep, for sure. So it was cool.
So another moment on here, I'll knock this one out for both of us early.
Okay.
Voodoo clocks in at 28.
Okay, so what are your thoughts on this? Because I've seen a polarizing opinion about this. Is this good or is this bad? Like, what are you thinking?
Well, I wrote down two albums that were in the vicinity that that I think do it justice, because this is a good spot for this album, I think. You're only one spot below Wu-Tang Clan, and you're only four spots below Sgt. Pepper's, which was the number one album on this list for so many years. So, and you're in the vicinity of Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. So you're in a good place here if you're Voodoo. Now, there are albums above this that are worse than this, sure. But overall, you can say Voodoo comes out as one of the 30 best albums of all time. And I think that's fair.
Yeah. Yes.
I'd probably put it a little higher, but this album, as we've talked about, and again, I haven't been on this forever. You put me onto this album. The musicality, the legendary story behind it, the phenomenal performance. Like, we talk about the five factors here: features, production value. This one hits all the marks. Influence, ginormous. Like,
oh my god,
an entire generation of soul R&B. Yeah. And then you got the music videos, everything else on this one. Like, this is one of the greatest albums of all time, and it reached that spot. I just heard a podcast breaking down this album recently, and some of the ways gospel broke it down. It was one of those Spotify albums, and the way they talked about how gospel influences delivery, like, I know that's right up your alley there, like the layered vocals and everything else.
Okay. Yes. Keep going. I have a point to make, but go ahead.
So let me run down some of the tracks in here, because How Does It Feel? Untitled, obviously one of the greatest R&B soul ballads of all time, the lead single off this one, the one that brought so many people into this album. But the deeper cuts on here too: Devil's Pie, Jay Dilla, the influence there, the drumming of Questlove on this album, unreal. You have more. We talk about Wu-Tang Clan; they make an influence on this album and left and right.
Yep.
This is so good. You have Spanish influence. You have. What more can you say? This album just has everything. Sexiness, rap, incredible hooks. Like, this is one of the greatest albums of all time.
Yeah, for sure. Like, Voodoo is top three of all time on my list. So seeing it in the spot that it had, I was not upset, only because I had to, like, bring my mind back, or bring it back to remembrance, that this is supposed to be a list of albums from all time, like all time. So I think when we bring that into context, 30 is not 30, right? It was
28.
You said it was 30? 28. Sorry. 28. It was that's amazing. And I think it speaks to the influence and the musicality, the musicianship, the story of the album. From top to bottom is complete flames. I would tell anybody that. So I loved singing Voodoo that high. I don't know if I would push it higher, actually. I think it's in a nice spot to where albums that even influenced that, you know, people may not know about could be taken into consideration. Even though that was not the case on this list, I think that 28 was a very comfortable spot. But going back to your point, you heard a podcast. By the way, I didn't know which podcast that is, so I can check it out. going back to the podcast, and they were talking about the gospel influences that were on that project. I think that's another thing that stuck out to me, which it could just be because I am a gospel music head, but the fact that there were no gospel albums on this on this list does not surprise me. But it always
get
sucks.
Into that because there was some missing stuff on here, but that's brutal. You can't make the 500 greatest albums of all time and ignore
and not include anything. It was incredible, and not even like the contemporary stuff. Like when you're looking at like your Kirk Franklin's, who literally revolutionized. We can even say hip hop, but even the way that hip hop is infused into gospel music now. We can talk about Commission. We can talk about, you know, the Winans. We can talk about the Clark Sisters, Andre Crouch, the Hawkins. I know I'm missing some more people, but all of those, even Aretha Franklin,
Aretha
most successful,
times, yeah.
Her most successful project is her gospel album.
Yeah.
And that wasn't included. So,
why do you think that is? My thinking on it is, especially for this generation, depending on who you are, but I think as the generations have gone on, people as a whole have become less religious. So I think you have less religious minds in the game. Now that's not 100% true, because I think an artist like Anderson .Paak, hugely influenced by playing at his church, gospel, all those different things. But I think on the whole, our generation is just less religious, so there's less thinking of that kind of music.
Yeah, and I also think that gospel is a genre, specifically gospel is a genre that reduces the critical framework. So, you know, of course we talk about all of these artists, and most of them, and producers, most of them grew up in the church. That's where they learned how to do pretty much everything. The chords that you feel, blues, gospel is the beginning for everything, for blues, for rock, for jazz, for hip hop. Like it's the foundation for everything. So, but the genre itself has never had the opportunity to flex its critical muscle. So when we talk about musicianship and we talk about musicality, we never take gospel into consideration because it's a solely religious thing. It's something that I listen to on Sundays and that's it. And that's for people who actually listen to gospel. For people who don't listen to gospel, they will never know. Like the names I just named, the Clark Sisters, when we talk about Twinkie Clark and how she just is a genius, you know, people have to like ask who that is because they simply don't know. And the history of music has never given proper deference to somebody like, you know, Twinkie Clark or Andre Crouch, who literally brought races together, you know, with his music. So I think in general, gospel has always been the ugly stepchild.
Yeah.
Especially when we're talking about the framework of music. And, you know, that sucks because I started off in gospel. I'm a church kid, so that's my foundation for me. And I study gospel. I study the history of it. And I just wish that, you know, it was taken more into consideration, especially when we look at the evolution of music itself. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's so many different reasons for that. And what's interesting is an artist like D'Angelo, you would ask many of the artists on these lists about their influences, and many of them would probably say gospel is among them.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But the listenership, radio play, all the other things that come into what's popular, what's influential in music, don't spread that sound directly. Now there's undertones of it, but that's why the singular genre of gospel ends up missing here. There were some other things I thought were missing in here. We might as well hit on that now. Artists specifically, two big ones for me. I mean, less so is J. Cole.
Yes.
He's not on here.
I
wouldn't put him on here.
Yeah,
I probably wouldn't. But it's just interesting to me that the big artists of this generation, Kendrick, Drake, those two specifically end up on there, but J. Cole doesn't. Mm. But the one I thought was more of a snub was Tyler, the Creator. Especially with his last two albums. And maybe those haven't had enough chance to grasp on and influence people, but we know they're going to. They already have. Like you see Logic's latest album already sampled the Eagle track. Tyler, the Creator, even if you don't love his albums, the influence is ginormous. He's going to go down as one of the most influential artists on clothing, culture, demeanor, branding yourself beyond music, whether it be TV shows, merchandise, those different things. He was one of the biggest in doing that. And did he have the albums up until Flower Boy? Probably not. I don't think any of those albums were worthy of being in consideration for this. But now that he's found his sound, now that he's consolidated himself, he's going to be on there, no doubt. And you already see different disciples of him go on to have huge careers, whether it be Steve Lacy, The Internet, Sid, those kind of people. And they're all among the most popular artists today. Even a Mac Miller was highly influenced by that kind of scene.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's crazy. I didn't even think of Tyler, the Creator until you said it. But yeah, man, I would at least think that Flower Boy and Igor, that would be a part of those, a part of the list. But no, that's really crazy. And also, yeah, J. Cole, I think I personally wouldn't put him on that list, but I guess the closest thing you would do is there's a case for like 2014. There's also a case for Friday Night Lights if you wanted to do so. But overall, I don't think that he would have fit on that list. But then again, you have albums like, you know, If You're Reading This, It's Too Late.
Yeah.
That is, I would have never thought that would end up on the list. But
I think Drake and J. Cole fall into a similar space where they've had ginormous songs, big influence, huge popularity, distinctive fan bases, but the albums that they've put out haven't been great albums front to back. They're more driven by their singles and their influence on others around them. J. Cole specifically, it feels like he's going to be remembered more for what he's done with his Dreamville label, putting some phenomenally talented artists like Ari Lennox, JID, Earth Gang on, rather than what he's done in his solo career. And you've seen it, his solo work has slowed down in favor of more label related things and features.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, but even going back to like Drake, because I think Take Care was on here and it was ranked
78.
It was pretty high. I think I'm like, what the hell? Like, no, I would have never done that.
95 wrong, but still top 100.
yeah, which is way too high in my opinion. But I mean, again, you have to keep in mind who's voting on these things, and you know, especially going back to who you named like a while back. Take Care was really important. It was a culturally significant album of his time. So, I mean, it makes sense, but, you know, I wouldn't have put it that high. Another thing that was really interesting to me is Beyonce, just her period, her presence on the list. I think Beyonce and Lemonade, they were like in the top 100. I believe so.
I think Beyonce's either there just outside, and then Lemonade falls in at 32.
Which is incredibly high, in my opinion. Especially because I was looking at, you know, Janet Jackson, who is another person. I'm glad that she's on there a few times, actually. But, you know, Rhythm Nation and The Velvet Rope, two very, very, very important albums, critically, commercially, and culturally. They were in the 300s, so it kind of makes you think, what was the criteria for these people for this voting process? How did they vote? What in their mind made them go with Beyonce and Lemonade over The Velvet Rope and Rhythm Nation? Which in a lot of ways kind of set the foundation for it, because there is a case to be made for the visual album, but you know, Rhythm Nation specifically, that definitely set the foundation for Beyonce's two projects to even exist. So it kind of makes you think about what exactly went into this list. And it also makes you realize, or it, you know, it kind of concludes that you shouldn't take this list too seriously.
Wow, really?
Because I think that's what I concluded from the list, that music is definitely subjective.
Yeah.
No matter how many times I try to make it objective or how many fancy words I can say in a critical analysis about music, it's all subjective. Exactly. It's all subjective. And I think that it varies from person to person. And even though I think that Lemonade may be a little too far up, it definitely deserved, space on this list for sure. So I'm not entirely too upset.
You won't catch me saying a bad thing about Beyonce.
No, I mean, listen, I love Beyonce. Lemonade was a moment.
What's her best album?
Beyonce's? I would say Lemonade.
Yeah.
I would say Lemonade because of how tight it was. It was just like, it was phenomenal. But I'm interested I didn't see B-Day on there. I didn't see Sasha Fierce on there, even though I personally don't like Sasha Fierce.
No.
I think that the album itself definitely made its impact. So I don't know.
Love on top. I mean, a lot of her albums, especially early on, were driven by those big, big singles. Lemonade, finally, mm-hmm. front to back, concise, and sent a strong, strong message. It was a moment. It was definitely a moment that I can remember over the last 10 years of it making waves. Interesting in parallel with 444. 444 doesn't make it, but that's another album. Mm-hmm. Maybe just because of Lemonade that made a bombshell mm-hmm. drop, held people's attention for days. Doesn't make the list. I'd probably call that a snub. I love Blonde making 79, and Frank Ocean gets on here twice. Another Tyler, the Creator disciple, who... Yep. It's a big impact on this list, but no Tyler. Frank's story is incredible. Goes away for 4 years, has a great debut. Important features on the Kanye Jay-Z album, and builds just this groundswell, internet following. And everybody wonders what's going to be the next big album, and the hype kept building and building and building. And I'm at a football practice watching the Patriots, and I see the New York Times article that Boys Don't Cry is coming. And how many did I know you back then? No, but we were probably both on Twitter wondering where Boys Don't Cry is. Never gonna come. And it built up the pressure to deliver here. Mm. And Channel Orange was so good. It makes the top 300, I believe. And it's a nice R&B modern soul record, and he comes out with this Blonde follow-up that has elements of the Beatles and indie music and alternative, and of course some soulful R&B moments on here too, a little bit of rap. Mm-hmm. He has that follow-up visual project that came out right before it, but Blonde to me, one of the most important albums in my life. Going away to college, listen to this, going through the homesickness, going through my dad's struggle, and just the sadness, the raw emotion of this album. One of the great breakup albums of all time, and the lust that it has. And if you're missing someone, if you're missing something, I think Blonde speaks to you in a powerful way, especially Self-Control, which to me is one of the 10 best songs of the decade. It's just the emotion, the performance, the feeling you get out of that song, and the bridge on it is just so great. Quieter moments, louder moments on this album, nights, visuals. This album, I would put it even higher. It's one of the great alternative albums I've ever heard. It's tough to even put this in a box because the influences were wide. And the performance was outstanding. And not only did it meet high expectations, it exceeded them by a million times. One of my favorite albums ever.
For sure. When we talk about like genre bending, I think that Blonde did it in such like a masterful way. So I was not surprised by Frank's appearances at all. Well deserved. And honestly, like, I don't know. I don't even know if mixtapes can make it on to this, but even going back to Nostalgia Ultra, like, I would include that just because of what was going on around that time in music. It was like, I believe in 2010.
2011.
Okay, yeah. And people were just looking for this new sound in R&B, moving out of the late 2000s. They were looking for this new sound, and Frank came in, you know, just hitting hard with the mixtape of this, just like this indie R&B alternative type of sound, but something that was familiar, but something that was also like forward, which was incredible.
Yeah,
and it R&B definitely catapulted his career.
Yeah, right around him, that shifted R&B from like a, you know, hip hop connect, where you'd have like these R&B hooks, rap lines of the 2000s, yep. Usher, all that different kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. More of like a soul and sexiness driven thing that was that came from that D'Angelo era around 1999, 2001. Mm-hmm. So that came to define that era. And then 2011, 10 years later, Frank brings a more melodic, jazz influenced, and, you know, sad.
Yeah.
Sad kind of thing. Like, you went from like sexy, uplifting club bangers to kind of introspective, sadder sounds that people could wallow in during this era.
Yeah, for sure. Like, and even, I know this person did make an appearance, and I kind of wish they did, but Miguel, when I look at his work,
had him as one of the snubs. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, even if you're not talking about All I Want Is You, which was incredible, it was a sound that we've never heard before. Even, I think that album came out in 2010. So it was definitely a year before Frank even came on the scene. But just that whole alternative feel to R&B, especially a sound that was driven by men, because we heard that sound before from women, even when we're looking at The Velvet Rope or Brandy's Full Moon or Aaliyah, the Red album. I'm kind of upset about Brandy not being on there either, but that's another topic. Yeah. But anyway, the men who had something to say in that space, Miguel was definitely a part of that movement, especially when we look at Kaleidoscope Dream. I think that album had Adorn, and How Many Dreams.
If there was any album, it would have been that one.
Yeah,
that's another.
Yeah,
I think that was another transition point in that transition we talk about to the modern R&B. John Legend plays a part in both eras.
Oh yeah,
and he's missing on here. You have his first album. I'm blanking on the name, and then you have that second album.
Lifted,
and then you have the second big album about 10 years later with Rick Ross and all those different appearances that I think fit more in this moment. And I even see him embracing some trap sounds and some The album that just came out from him, like, he adapts to eras in such a outstanding way. Get Lifted would have been the one from him that would have made this list.
Wow, he did make it. That's crazy.
Any other appearances that stick out to you? I got two more before we get out of here.
Let me see. Let me go back to my list, see if any. It was good to see. I don't know if this is a surprise, but it was good to see Golden Hour by Casey Musgraves. I personally love that album. When we talk about country music and how it's been influenced by pop in a way that we kind of give Taylor Swift credit, especially when we look at like her album Red, which is on here. I think Casey Musgraves and Golden Hour specifically really kind of drives that point home and does it in a masterful way. So I was glad that that album made it onto the list. I believe that album is like two or three years old.
That was a big one. I knew quite a few people that loved that album.
Yeah, it's incredible. It won Album of the Year like 2 years ago or something. Or a year ago, I think. Yeah, a year ago. I was glad to see that album on there.
I told you this already, but Low End Theory coming in at 43. Fitting. Phenomenal. Fife Dog, of course, dies within the last few years, so tribute to him. They have two appearances on here, then Midnight Marauders. I think, again, the last 4 years probably don't get caught in this list because we haven't looked back on it in retrospect yet, but their follow-up 20 years after the Love Movement in We Got It From Here, the tribute to Fife Dog, the election politics of it, integrating newer artists like Anderson .Paak into that album, and the chemistry. Forget the chemistry from being off for 20 years, but the chemistry of Q-Tip trying to interact with Fife Dog beyond the grave.
We talk about
performance. I call a lot of performances on here great. To integrate mid-session vocals and mid-composition and just, I mean, Fife Dog came up with the title of the album and kind of the concept of the album. For Q-Tip to carry that forward in a way that felt like Fife Dog wasn't absent from this project at all. Magnificent. But Low End Theory, what more can you say? Influenced all of low end hip hop after it. Still did it in 1993 better than anyone, I think.
Absolutely.
We gave To Pimp a I gave To Pimp a Butterfly credit as the best jazz rap album. This one's number two easily and was number one
for
years. And it was different in that it integrated jazz legends like Ron Carter and others instead of just simply sampling it. They worked with those legends and integrated them, and it spoke to A Tribe Called Quest, which was a community. They would pull in a Consequence, a J Dilla. It wasn't strictly its core four members or eventually three members as it was. I love that group to death. Sad to think that they're gone. They're not performing at this point, but we still have Q-Tip alive to carry on their legacy and their memory.
I believe those. A Tribe Called Quest is personally responsible for influencing my favorite hip-hop duo, Outkast, so I have nothing but respect for them. I definitely wish We Got It From Here had more consideration, even in this time.
There was enough time.
But, you know.
It didn't get Grammy nominated either.
No, it did not, which was that,
It stacks. I mean, they have legendary albums, and it stacks up there with them, which
absolutely
blew my mind.
Absolutely.
All right. So you mentioned Outkast. They appear on here a few times. I believe the highest ranking one of those albums was
Stankonia, I think, was the highest. Was it Aquemini?
I think Aquemini came in just ahead of Stankonia.
Okay. That's fair.
The double album comes in. No AT Aliens, though, which is the darkest, their darkest album, I'd say. And some of their best lines are on there. Live by the Beat, Die by the Beat. Those different kind of things. I wish that squeezed in there, but how many Outkast albums, I guess, could you squeeze in there? Probably four. I mean, they would have been a group that was deserving of four. Kendrick gets three on here. Yeah. Kanye gets six. So you could have squeezed in all Outkast albums.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there's not enough time for me to talk about Outkast. They're just... Outkast is there.
All right, so here's something that's missing here. You got Outkast, you got The Solace. We talked about those two things already. Trap missing on here largely. Especially, we're probably pushing on a decade of trap being the sound of hip hop and pop rap music now. Such an unlikely rise. Like, you growing up listening to trap that was distinctive to The Solace, I'm probably stunned that that became the sound of an era. Like, it was just such an unlikely ascension for that sound. Yeah. But no Travis Scott, no T.I. or the likes.
No T.I. That's what I'm really interested in.
Like, new age and old age trap. You didn't get a ton of it. And then, you know, the way that
A lot of Lil Wayne.
Yes, Carter 3. Carter 3. Yeah.
Okay.
So trap, I mean, like I said, you got funk, you got hip hop, you got R&B, you got soul on here, but no trap feels like a miss. Now, am I the biggest trap fan? Are there any trap albums that speak to me? Probably not, but there's got to be there could have been a voice in that room that would have hyped up a future album or a Travis Scott album or, you know, one of those new age. Because I look at what the kids are listening to and what's connecting right now, and it's all trap influenced.
Yeah, I mean, that's trap music is the wave. I mean, it just is what it is. So, I mean, I'm not too surprised that they're not on there. But it does suck. I wish more consideration was given to trap music. But I think that even though trap music is popular, it's not it's not regarded as something that is supposed to be taken seriously. Yeah. So I think maybe in the next list we'll see trap music be integrated. I mean, definitely with Cardi B. If you're talking about modern times, Cardi B, Migos, just the way that they have
Invasion of Privacy is probably a top 500 album ever.
Absolutely, like Invasion of Privacy, and crazy enough, I don't even think that Lil Kim made it on there. I don't remember seeing Lil Kim on there. Her Hardcore album, which, again, when we look at the history of music, when we look at the history of hip hop specifically, we have to talk about Lil Kim's Hardcore. We have to put that with Missy Elliott, who did make an appearance with Super Duper Fly, so that was dope.
That's number 10. So you did you had your female rappers on there representing a big way. I love Miss Education in general being the top hip hop album on this list. Now there's a bunch of different influences that come together on that album, but you talk about an album for everybody, you'll find many ranges of people from all different backgrounds that love that album, that grew up on that album, that continue to listen to that album on the radio. You hear doo-wop and all those different hits off there on the radio to this day. 10. I think you look at that and you go, wow, 10. But it fits. It fits. Yeah. I think it does.
Yeah. I'd have to agree. That album was great.
So we'll throw one more back and forth before we get out of here. What would I point out? Anthy Makes It. We both love that album. Control, we reviewed that album. Makes It on the back end. Unlikely, but I loved it. Three D'Angelo appearances. Mad Villainy. Couple of M albums. El Mac Herrera from Rosalia. Seat at the Table. Two women who are going to make waves for years to come right there in Rosalia and Solange. This list was great. Now, are there any albums on here that I disagreed with? If I had a point to one, it'd probably be Yeezus, because influential maybe, but as a singular piece of work, didn't love it.
No, it was not new. I mean, it is influential, but not nearly influential to even talk about
people,
it.
I think people overrate the influence of it because people have done similar things in a better way. And even if you want to talk about putting Travis Scott on, I think Travis Scott had already put himself on to some degree there. That just helped a little bit. And when you look in retrospect, it was a downward trend for Kanye's career from there. Any other album on here stick out to you?
Not really. I mean, I feel like every album that made it, even the newer ones, I think Billie Eilish being on there was dope. Well deserved. So it was cool seeing her. But I think overall it was a solid list. Yes. I'm surprised going back to like 90s R&B, I'm surprised more 90s R&B didn't make it on there. Mary J. Blige made it on there a few times. But like, I don't know. I had to be like understand that even though albums, you know, my community reveres as like, you know, huge, successful, culturally important albums, that doesn't mean that it should make the 500 list of all time. So
there's quite a few albums, especially the older guard like the Beatles, Bob Dylan, Michael Jackson, Radiohead, all these different people, David Bowie, Elton John, Rolling Stones. They're gonna be on here forever in some shape or form. Yeah. I wonder, as we continue to do these for the next decades to come, how strongly some of the albums from this era, Control, most specifically, I love Control, but how strongly will an album like that grip onto this as one decade passes, as two decades passes? How strongly will Kendrick hold on to his top 30, top 40 holds there?
He's holding. He's gonna hold.
But I mean, there are some mainstays on here, and we talk about 186 albums from the 2000s coming on to here. There's going to be some there that don't hold on strongly as time starts to pass. Like there, some of the stuff that we wanted to see on here, we said maybe it's too soon, but there was stuff that recently made it on here and probably won't hold on, especially as we start to factor in some of the things we wanted to see on here.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm not too sure about like why that is the case. If they really don't have that it factor to keep them on that long, or if it's because an album has to leave, but it's not going to be like who you said, Bob Dylan or the Rolling Stones or the Beatles or any Elton John or any artist like that. So I guess the album that we're willing to give up is a classic, but it came out more recent, so we can push that to the side. I'm not too sure about like why these albums won't hold, but I am curious to see what the next 10 years will look like, or if they'll increase the number maybe, or I mean, I don't know. It's hard to condense all of these years of popular music into 500, you know, slots. So we'll see.
We'll be pushing 100 years of recorded music soon too. Yeah, it's crazy to think the album's young. Like the album is young, and I think one of the interesting things that they talked about here is that it seemed like the album was dying as the sale of the album started to fade away. But the concept of having an album, having a story, having a theme, all those different things, even as singles and individual songs and shuffle mode and all that stuff came into play, still stand strong. And you still have albums that are associated around something. It's not just a loose collection of songs. The playlist is going to be interesting for years to come, whether that starts to dominate more than the album. But for now, the album's still strong.
Yeah, for sure. That's a scary thought, but yeah.
Mel Smith, Bobby Manning, always great to do some Music Monday on here, no matter the day.
Sure.
We'll have a lot of reaction to this NBA season, what's to come in the world of sports, Spotify, iTunes, all those different platforms, realbobmanning.com. And check us out, video version, outtakes on CLNS Media. Mel, talk to you soon.